And this year, we decided to take a topic that I've actually written about and gotten some flack for, although not, I hasten to add from Rabbi Artson, not yet anyway. And that is about whether rabbis should talk politics from the pulpit. So I wrote an article a few months ago saying that they shouldn't. Obviously, as we're going to discuss, the lines are slippery, but that by and large, they shouldn't. And the essential reasons I gave were, first of all, it drives away everyone who doesn't agree with your politics, drives them out of the synagogue. It makes synagogues political places rather than Jewish places. You know, that's a Democratic synagogue, that's a Republican synagogue. Third, rabbis don't know more about politics than anybody else, so you're using your position illegitimately to advance a political view that you claim is the view by being a rabbi. And lastly, because it seems to me that if you do that, you're being a little bit dishonest about the variety of Torah. Because I think you could easily say that the Torah supports a far right wing, a far left wing, somewhere in the middle, virtually any position. As Louis Ginsburg, the great Talmud scholar and Midrash scholar, used to say, the devil can quote scripture to his purpose. In other words, the devil can find a verse in the Bible that supports him. And if he were more learned, the devil could quote the Talmud too. So for all those reasons, but I have to tell you, a lot of people did not agree with me. And I wonder if you do.
We can't just go back to talking about dancing bar mitzvah kids.
No, we exhausted that one. No.
So I'm 80% with you. I would tweak the statement. I think rabbis should generally avoid partisan politics from the Bima. But here's where that becomes problematic and challenging, including, you know, Zionist readings of the Mazor.
Right.
Which you just witnessed from Mr. Non-Politics here.
Well, that's Israel. That's not politics.
So I have two look, I also avoid partisan issues from the pulpit and for the reasons you laid out. But I want to complicate the waters a bit. So the first is, let's say rabbis should avoid partisan politics because you're as well informed as we are and good people can have different opinions on subjects, all of which is true. So rabbis should stick to talking about values instead, and our job is to elicit the Torah values. But what you said about politics is also true of values, meaning you can have a right-wing reading of Torah values and a left-wing reading of Torah values. Does the Torah support the equality of women? Yes or no? Well, it depends on which rabbi you ask and which community. So ultimately, if the issue is if there's more than one way to do it, then rabbis should say nothing, then we can't say much of much. So that's one challenge. And the second challenge, and I don't have a simple answer for this, because I do think rabbis should avoid partisan issues, is at what point do values slide into politics? See, the assumption is you could have a value that isn't political. But at the end of the day, all politics is people debating what really matters to them. So at what point does our discussion of values stop being political? And I guess I have a third challenge for us to think about, and I don't have an answer for this, but here's the question. Rabbi Wolpe is good enough every year to come to speak to the rabbinical students at the Ziegler School, and he presented what his approach is to addressing political topics, and then he said, which he whispered to me just now, except for Israel. Now, I, like Rabbi Wolpe, fully believe that rabbis need to be explicit and frequent in speaking about the vital importance of Israel. So on that, but that is political. It's very political. And wait, here's the challenging part of that. If we want other people to also come forward and speak about the importance of Israel, then don't we have to speak about their equivalent issues too? Do we only speak out about anti-Semitism, or do we also then have an obligation to speak out against all bigotry? Because a community that's comfortable being racist is one that will be anti-Semitic. And so originally that's why the ADL became an anti-defamation league about all defamations, because even if we wanted to, we can't simply say, well, the only bigotry you can't express in public is anti-Jewish bigotry, but for the rest of it, say whatever you want.
I agree. So what I would say about Israel and about bigotry, I actually think that saying, for example, this government is good for Israel, that government is good for Israel, is a political statement. But that isn't what I said. I said people who are happy or supportive that Israel exists, right? I didn't say people who are happy or supportive that this or that person is prime minister. And I actually think that that is a fundamental Jewish value, that Jews should live in the land of Israel and that Jews should have a land of Israel. And there is no Jewish tradition virtually without that. So I don't find that political. I would have a harder time saying this particular position from the pulpit. This particular position of the Israeli government I support and this one I don't. The one time where I violated that, and I don't know now that I should have, based on my own principles, was with the Iran deal, but I am willing to concede that that may have been a violation of my own principles to speak about it. About bigotry, though, I don't see bigotry as, I don't see, for example, saying you shouldn't hate based on race, creed, color, religion. Well, I don't see that as a political issue at all. What I see as a political issue is making that a legislative question so that you pass this law and you don't pass that law. So you support this group, but you don't support that group. But I cannot imagine any rabbi anywhere who couldn't get up and say racism is wrong and not feel like they were speaking not politically, but Torah values-y. Now, I do acknowledge that there's some inevitable slide, one into the other. You can't help it. I think that that's true. And I'll give you an example. So, for example, if you say all Americans should have health care, is that a value statement or is that a political statement? Well, it's not entirely clear, actually. Which it is, I would say it's a political statement because the question, of course, is not, the question is always, what does that mean in terms of the politics of it? But you could say, if you want to make a very anodyne, that is not impactful and not particularly important statement, you could just say, yeah, all Americans should have health care, and leave it at that, and I think people would say, well, what do you mean by that, Rabbi? And you would say, I just mean everybody should. And according to my principles, it would be perfectly legitimate. But as soon as you say, what that means is we should expand Medicare, you have every right to say, really, what do you know about Medicare expansion? And do you know more than all the people in the congregation who actually know something about it? So I think there is a line that you can most of the time identify that's pretty clear. No?
Look, de facto, yes. So this is my 19th high holiday at Sinai Temple. And so thank you for that. Thank you for that. And I have managed thus far to have 19 high holidays in which I have never given a partisan talk. And I think we've talked about some important human things over the years. But it does strike me as a little weird to suggest that rabbis should avoid the important social issues of their time, even though I agree, I'm not better informed than my congregants about how to solve the problem. Okay, so let me try a different thing.
Okay.
Maybe what rabbis should avoid is policy recommendations dressed up as Torah. Right?
Sure.
So for example, I would hope that were I a rabbi in 1963-64, I would hope that I would have been one of the rabbis who would have addressed the issue of race and civil rights.
Right.
You know, and some of the giant conservative rabbis of the time, including reform rabbis, of course, as well, did eloquently bring Torah to bear on the issue of human dignity and institutionalized racism, and they were roundly condemned at the time for violating what we're going to call the second Wolbe principle.
I like the sound of that. Yeah.
The first one has to do with Passover, and I'm not going there.
He means that everyone should celebrate it. That's the first Wolbe principle. So everyone should celebrate
exactly
Passover.
What I meant. So, but they were criticized for being political,
right?
Because there were a lot of very religious people who, on religious grounds, believed that Martin Luther King was a communist and believed that once you start arguing that black people should have equal rights, that the very fundamentals of American democracy would erode and our sacred traditions would dissolve. So that it becomes hard for me in the practice.
It's always slippery. Look, those of you who know, and those of you who don't will in a second, that I gave a speech in which I criticized the president for what he said and did not say about Charlottesville. I didn't think that was political at all. I still don't, even though many people did. I really thought that was, if you can't say Nazis are bad as a first reaction, then I think every rabbi in the world has a right to say, no. The first reaction has to be Nazis are bad. Whatever you say second.
Okay, wait, but
right?
Let me jump in.
Yeah.
Should a rabbi speak out if all he refused to do was say the KKK is bad, but he said nothing about Nazis? So Nazis were
irrelevant.
I think
you could certainly make an argument, but the Nazi argument was the easiest argument.
Yeah.
It's like, give it to me on a silver platter.
I understand, but so the question is,
right?
We as a Jewish community,
you're allowed to have special interests as a community. That seems to me fair, right? Not all attacks are equal. If someone attacks my family, it feels different to me than if someone attacks your family, even though I'd be very upset.
Thanks, I appreciate that.
Really, I would.
And let me just say to all of you that my wife is a federal prosecutor, so if you want to try attacking my family, you go right ahead. Sure, so it is itself a Jewish value that we should stick up first for ourselves. And I think that's true for all peoples, that they should have enough healthy regard for their own dignity that they have every obligation to speak first for themselves. But as a rabbi, we speak for one of the world's wisdom traditions. Torah doesn't claim to just be a parochial book about Jews. It says something about God's sovereignty in the world. Right? In that day, God's name will be one. And so there's a universal impulse. So I did notice with some discomfort that Jews who had not felt the need to speak out against anti-Mexican or anti-Muslim or anti-black statements from very powerful people in the United States leapt to their feet when all of a sudden we were in the crossfire. And that makes me very uncomfortable.
I think there's a qualitative difference. First of all, there's a difference because those statements were in the context of a political either campaign or a policy. And second, Nazis are Nazis. Anti-Mexican statements are bad, and yes, there's been discrimination against Mexicans. Nazis murdered 6 million Jews and plunged the world into a world war and sent hundreds of thousands of Americans to their death in that war. And to make any kind of equivalence between condemning someone who says bad things about Mexicans, who last time I visited the country were fine, but people who don't condemn Nazis seems to me really apples and oranges. Very, very different. If you want to...
So I just want to note the masterful rhetorical move that Rabbi Wolpe engaged in. And I do want to say that I am categorically opposed to Nazis.
Okay. Now, and I, by the way, as you know, I took umbrage at the other statements that you're talking about. I thought that, we don't have to go through which ones in particular, although we can. I thought that they were anywhere from distasteful to despicable. But I didn't think that any of them was equivalent to not condemning Nazis. I mean, just, I don't think, and I don't think that's only a reaction as a Jew. I think that's a, I think, I, by the way, if you look around the world, people reacted differently to that than they did to other things, even when they objected to other things.
I still don't like Nazis.
So, you're sure?
I'm not going to get into a conversation of who's equally bad.
But you did just now. You said I was uncomfortable that they condemned this, but not that.
Because they're in the same neighborhood. Look, there is a Beverly Hills adjacent. I want to remind you guys of that. And so it may not be Beverly Hills, but it's next door. So, you know, I wonder if someone had been running for office saying we need to prevent Jews from immigrating into this country, we would have been screaming from the rooftops and demanding of others that they do the same. So here's the thing. I know that you're not in favor of a Judaism so parochial that fundamental human liberties only cross our agenda when they're about us.
Thank you for saying that. And I know,
I'm a nicer guy than you
are. I know
that
you don't like Nazis at all.
I'm glad we've established that. Right? So part of the challenge, and we all struggle with this, is of course we expect to allow a presidential campaign to run its course because I read the same newspaper as you do, and so I don't have an inside line on that, on policy choices. But the times where candidates or public figures cross that line and they make gross, disparaging comments about entire ethnic or religious groups, is that politics under the Wolby rule, or is that values?
So I would say that part of this is the same thing that I experienced after the Houston flood. I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but after the, like a day or two after the flood in Houston, which is a terrible thing, I think 40 people died, 50 people died, many were displaced. A day or two later, there was a flood in Southeast Asia where 1,500 people died. I didn't hear anyone raising money for the people in Southeast Asia, who are probably, by the way, much more impoverished than the people in Houston. And this has to do with what Derek Parfit called the bias of the near. Parfit said, and by the way, I'll give you a really useful piece of life advice here. I really mean it. This is worth it. Parfit was a brilliant Oxford philosopher. He died last year, but ever since I heard this, it has changed the way I live my life and will change yours if you take it in. Parfit said, look, if you saw a kid sitting here who was starving, you would feed him. No question. Everybody here would immediately. But you know that there are kids starving in Africa and you don't send them money. Why? He said, because the way human beings work is the bias of the near. That which is close to you, you react to. And I understand, so this is the first part. And I understand that what you're criticizing is the actions of the bias of the near. And yes, it's constant struggle. How close, when do you stand up for people who are other than you? How serious is the question? All of that. And that's a great moral dilemma, and I certainly acknowledge it. And I wrote actually about it, although I didn't so much speak about it. I wrote about immigration in a Time article, and I tried to do it in a way that was sensitive to the political issues. But here's the thing that can help your life. Parfit said, what people don't realize is that the bias of the near works in time as well as space. So if I say to you, do you want to come to my house for dinner tonight, and you don't want to come, you'll say, no, I'm sorry, tonight, unfortunately, I have something. Right? Whether you have something or not. But if I then say to you, okay, do it in 6 months, you'll say, sure, 6 months. He says, because you don't realize that in 6 months it's going to be tonight. And so he said, the same bias of the near should apply, which is, if you get asked to do something in the future, always ask yourself, do I want to do it today? And if you don't want to do it today, the answer is no. Because you're going to be the same in 6 months. Now, this has nothing to do with our conversation, but I think you should get a little life wisdom from coming to show on Rosh Hashanah. And I can't tell you how many things when someone says, will you do this in 3 months? And I think, I think now, because of Parfit, would I want to do it tonight? If you don't want to do it tonight, you're not going to want to do it. And how often have you said, I don't know why I agreed to this, right? And the reason you agreed to it is because it was far in the future. So it didn't seem real. But I am here to tell you, it will be real. So don't do it. Unless it's an invitation from the synagogue. Because then it's for God and you should. I think that more or less sums it up.
I have no response. Except I do want to affirm I dislike Nazis.
What I find actually remarkable about this conversation is that it happens that right in the course of this conversation, our former mayor, Antonio Villaraigosa, walked in and sat down. I don't know if you noticed, but you can certainly say hello to everybody. Why don't you... And I do want to say in a purely non-political way, the mayor Villaraigosa has attended services at high holiday services at Sinai Temple for as long as I remember. Years when he was in office, years when he wasn't in office, years when he was running for office, years when he wasn't running for office. So, in a purely non-political way, wonderful to see you. It's a very tricky line. So actually what I was thinking, you maybe were going to say, and I'd like to ask you this, is when non-Jewish preachers talk about Israel in a positive way, I'm always pleased. But the truth is they're violating my rule, aren't they?
Apparently, they are. So here's, look, because I'm going to come to it from the opposite.
Okay.
I often get asked to sign letters about in favor or opposed to various things, and I often get pushed to make comments critical about Israel. And there I have the Artson rule, which is in private, speaking to an Israeli official, I will say anything I think. You will never, ever, ever hear me say something even vaguely critical of Israel in public, ever.
Even about... What about what's going on with the Western Wall? I took that as vaguely critical.
Okay, so we're back to dancing bar mitzvah kids here. The problem with the Western Wall and pluralism is it feels like a misguided issue. It's just a wall. You know? So I don't say that publicly because my movement cares very strongly.
This is private.
This is just us here. Mr. Mayor, don't let this out of the room. Right? So, but there are strong issues of Israeli pluralism that we should be standing up for. Honest to God,
yes.
The wall doesn't, I never daven at the wall. I don't find it inspiring at all. I think the part of being a Zionist is that every part of Israel is holy. So, you know, any house, hut, roof, tree, vista, it's all God's gift to the Jewish people. I'll pray at any of those places.
So,
and the wall is about power, which doesn't interest me.
So, just as you teased me about the first principle of Wolpe being Passover, the first principle of Artson is the wall's not holy, right?
You see, and I thought we were friends.
I mean, come on, it's the
what
wall.
What I will say to you is,
yes.
It's not the wall.
The wall is
no more holy,
yes,
than any other part of Eretz Yisrael.
I'm curious, how many of you agree with that? Come on. Very good. Okay, I'm not sure. I mean, I know one or two parts of Israel that might not entirely fit that description.
I don't visit those parts.
No, okay.
You may want to check his itinerary.
But I actually think, to a great extent, I agree with you. But there's a symbolic value to allowing people to pray at the wall that is very powerful.
Yes, thank you. For sure. And I think that is one of the places where the two principles look like they come into conflict. Right? Because if we just speak privately to Israeli officials about the need for pluralism, it doesn't make a dent. And so we end up screaming in public. But I think in some ways it does it makes us look weak the way we go about doing it. Right? In other words, I'm keenly aware we don't vote in Israeli elections, nor should we. We don't fight in Israeli wars. And that limits our ability to be able to dictate policies in a country that we love and is close to our heart, but we're not Israelis. We're not Israelis. So I think our job with Israelis and their job with us is to offer us strong opinions and advice as members of the family. And so we should speak to each other about that. But here's the question I say, so I also speak forcefully about the essential nature of Israel for Jewish identity everywhere. Clear that being alive today, Israel has to be at the heart of our hearts. And that I take as a rule of Jewish life in our time and one of the greatest privileges of our time. But I can't reduce Judaism to just loving a particular place. Judaism is also about all people being made in God's image. Judaism is about paying the workers on time, labor justice, about the importance of education. There are a whole bunch of Torah values that have immediate political implications, whether or not I support a policy or not. And sometimes, because of politics, it sounds political when you say that in public. So how do we navigate that?
So I think that's we're gonna wrap this up. I think part of the problem is things have become so politicized that if you say, for example, America is a land of immigration, it sounds like a political statement, when in fact it's an unarguable historical and contemporary statement. Or if you say, as you said, America should have like strong ethical or moral traditions, so that immediately makes you think, oh, it must be on one or another side of the political spectrum, and that's a shame. So what I would ask you in closing is, in seeing the terrible polarities of our politics and the way that each side forms such sort of cohesive teams and doesn't make any concession, how ought the Jew look with Torah eyes at the political scene? Do you have a principle or two we can...
Yeah, so here's what I'd like to advise us to try to do. It's not easy to do because, look, the way I read the Jewish Journal, for example, I go through it once to make sure that none of my friends are in trouble. Right? And then if they're not, then I go back to the beginning, I read it again. That's how I read the newspaper, too, by the way. I read the newspaper to make sure that my friends aren't indicted and Israel's not in trouble. And then I go back to the beginning and I read it all the way through again. But what if we approached issues and people without first thinking, are they on my side or against me? Right? In other words, people who are partisans, their first reaction is, I need to defend anything my side put out yesterday, and I need to condemn anything their side did. Right? So there are people for whom President Obama could do no wrong, and people for whom he could do no right, and there are people for whom Trump can do no wrong and no right. And I want to criticize both of them. I want to say that what we should do is vociferously criticize when we think people are living the wrong values at that moment, but not generalize it to their total existence, right? And if we did that, then we would have one yardstick. So whether you're a Hillary person or a Trump person, or I can't stand either one, or I love them both, although I guess there's not many in that category, right? Wherever you are, you have the same yardstick for how you evaluate the value of a policy suggestion or a statement. And it ends up not mattering whether that person was your person or their person. You offer the same evaluation regardless. I think if we did that, we would live in a culture in which we could actually trust each other's reactions. But you know as well as I do that Fox News is going to come down defending one set of characters and condemning the other, even when they say reasonable things, and will construe them in the worst possible way if it's not their people. And the liberal press will do the same, which means that most of us end up ignoring the evaluations of the so-called experts because it's just partisan. And maybe that's where we can agree.
And what I would say about that is that is a beautiful platonic ideal. That is, none of us are going to be able to do it all the time because we make cohesive judgments about character, about people. And some people you will like and some people you won't like, but you can constantly remind yourself of that principle. Okay, I know I don't like this person, but if someone else had said this, how would I feel about it? Or if someone else had enunciated that. So I think that part of Rosh Hashanah is reaching towards principles that we won't fully enact because we're going to be here again confessing next year, I predict. We're not going to be perfect during the year, but the idea of evaluating people, dam lekach zchut, right, to try to see their best side and to try to assume that there is something worthwhile in what they're saying, even if it comes from someone you don't like, that's not a bad principle. And so I want to once again say really how grateful and honored and delighted I am to be able to share the Bima with my friend of now a long freaking time, like many decades. Over probably about 35 years. Yeah, probably about 35
years. And we're looking good.
We are. And we have agreed like 70% of the time. Anyway, it's a great pleasure to have Rabbi Archon, and thank you.